This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to Aquarium Mania. I'm your host, Dr. Roy Anand, speaking to you from the University of Florida IFAS Tropical Aquaculture Laboratory. Thanks for joining us. Reef aquaria, from nanotanks to large, complex, high-tech systems, have exploded in popularity with increased knowledge and more advanced lighting and filtration. My guest today, Dr. Alex Hall, a recent vet school graduate with interest and growing expertise in reef diseases, has made a name for himself on social media as The Reef Vet. Join us as we discuss Alex's journey from child hobbyist to aquatic veterinarian and scientist. We'll be right back after these messages.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Aquarium Mania on Pet Life Radio. My guest today is Dr. Alex Hall III, an aquatic veterinarian and researcher with a strong interest in disease and health management of corals, fish, and other reef organisms. Thanks for joining us, Alex. So a lot of my interviews always start with a little bit of kind of personal questioning. So I want to talk to you a little bit about some of your early years. You told me your father had set up a reef tank before you were even born. Can you tell us a little bit about your father's tank and interest in the hobby and how that influenced you?
Yeah, so my dad set up a reef tank about 32 years ago. It's actually still up and running. He fell in love with it, you know, all those years ago. And then finally, when I was about 5 or 6, I started to get more interested into it. And then when I was about 10 years old, we had a tank crash, lost practically everything. That's when he decided that he was pretty much done with the hobby and didn't want to really partake in it anymore after that. So then I started to take over growing more soft corals like the mushrooms and some of the leathers and some of the easier corals to grow. And then over time, I just got more and more interested into it, got more involved with the corals, and now 7 tanks are running on that system.
That's great. So you basically just kind of cleaned up the system after it crashed and kind of restarted it again when your dad gave up?
Mm-hmm, yeah, it was pretty much almost a complete reboot. So it was nice to finally, you know, redo some of the equipment from, you know, the older generation that wasn't as efficient as some of the newer equipment. So I was able to do some upgrades and made my life a little bit easier.
Actually, I'm curious. So what kind of a filtration did he have back then?
So it was some filter floss and a homemade skimmer made out of, was it 12-inch PVC pipe and a bunch of air stones. That was all handmade in the wall.
Wow, that's pretty good. What about lighting?
Back then he was running metal halides.
Okay.
But unfortunately, the bulbs that we used to use are no longer manufactured. So then we switched over to LEDs and T5s.
Okay, cool. So you mentioned you have a bunch of tanks now, I guess you said off that system. What kind of things are you raising right now in those systems? I know you're interested in kind of culturing different things as well as just, you know, raising them for display.
Yeah. So in the biggest tank, I have 180 gallon. That's like a mixed reef setup. Mostly Acropora with some soft corals. Then I have a 55-gallon bubble tip anemone only tank, as well as a 30-gallon bubble tip only tank. I've got one little hospital system attached to that. Well, not really a hospital, but more of a quarantine. And then 2 tanks growing out various species of SPS, so small pop stony corals, LPS, large pop stony corals, as well as some softies.
That's great. All right. Well, I'm going to switch over a little bit. And let's talk a little bit about your kind of educational background. When and how did you decide to become a veterinarian and even more specifically, one that works in aquatics?
I was 5 years old when I decided I wanted to be a vet. It's the only job that I ever knew that I wanted to do. It wasn't until more recent years that I got into the aquatic medicine. Originally, I was, I'd say, you know, first, second year of veterinary knowledge in these areas. I became more interested in that pursuit of knowledge.
Well, that's great. So I guess when you were five, you were thinking kind of just dog and cat pretty much?
Yeah, I assume.
Did you have other pets at home then, or was this just something?
Yeah, so I've always had a lot of pets at home. My father used to breed snakes and lizards in my basement, so I always was around the reptiles, always had a lot of big dogs.
I was trying to figure out when to ask you, but somewhere in there, you also have to talk about judo, since it seems you're quite a judo expert as well, but maybe start kind of with the education first.
So I went to Stony Brook University for undergrad, majored in biochemistry and minored in organic chemistry. At that point, I applied to the Royal Veterinary College in London. So I ended up going over there. And the reason I ended up going over there was I've got my German citizenship. So I wanted to have my license to be able to practice in the US and in Europe if I decided one day that I wanted to go to Europe. So that school allowed me to have my licensure for both continents.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, I was curious because obviously that's kind of quite a distance. So I have to ask, and I know you may not be able to answer this really well, not having been here for school, but do you know of any like major differences between how veterinary schools educate in London versus here in the US?
The major difference is that I've seen, especially talking to my friends who've gone to school in the US, is that in the US, I feel like you're a lot, there's a lot more guidance and being babysat in terms of your classes and constantly having exams and constantly being, you know, people checking up on your work. Whereas in the UK, we only had one exam a year. It was completely cumulative and it could have been anything from that year or previous. So it was always constantly, you had to always, you weren't able to brain dump. You weren't able to just, you know, shove the information in your head for the exam, take the exam and forget about it. You had to remember it throughout the entire year.
Were they kind of similar or how did you?
Yeah, they are very similar. There's just, you know, some differences in like the parasitology versus the UK versus the US. Like in the UK, there is virtually no heartworm, whereas in the US, that's more of a more prevalent thing. So it's just knowing, you know, plant toxicology versus the US versus the UK, and infectious disease versus the US and the UK. Other than that, it's fairly similar.
Okay. And what about your classmates relative to kind of your interest in aquatics, and how did you kind of do aquatics in London? Were there a lot of opportunities, or how did that work?
No, so there wasn't a lot of opportunities. I mostly self-taught, reading as many of the textbooks and the literature that's out there. Fortunately, I've been mentored by Dr. Julius Tepper back from the States, because fortunately he lives like 30 minutes from me, well, my home base in New York. So he's been a great mentor and guidance through like the WAVMA Cert AQV program. But other than that, in school-wise, there was no fish really at all. Even the exotics team there doesn't really talk about fish or doesn't see fish. So in school-wise and people, you know, learning about my interest in fish, either people are really ecstatic about it and very interested, like, oh, how, you know, how is that progressing? Whereas other people, sometimes they don't really understand, like, oh, you see goldfish. And, you know, sometimes it's a little more in-depth than, you know, just like the normal problems.
Right. Were you able to do externships, I guess, in kind of aquatics, or and did you want to talk about any of that?
Yeah, so fortunately, I got to do some internships at the Long Island Aquarium, got to work with them and some of their pathology team. And then fortunately, with COVID, or unfortunately with COVID, I was home for about a year and a half. So during that time, I was able to work with Dr. Tepper and get some more hands-on experience.
Well, that's great. Now, I noticed too, when you kind of gave me some of your materials that you have done, are really interested in research.
Yeah, so in my undergrad, one of my senior research project was chemoselective modification of adenoviruses. So at that time, I was really involved in chemistry and really loved organics. And that project was essentially, it was theorized that adenoviruses would accumulate in thyroid cancer tissue. So my lab was trying to, or the lab I was working with was trying to prove that. So my job was to synthesize a molecule that would connect the virus to a radioactive marker molecule, so that once those two were connected and that virus was introduced to the body, we'd be able to see where in the body that virus was accumulating via PET scan.
Okay.
The second project was just protein synthesis, helping another lab. They were trying to help quantify bacterial proteins in the periplasmic space. So I was just helping synthesize proteins for them to do that.
Okay. And then in vet school?
So vet school, I was working with French bulldogs.
And now you're pursuing a master's. So you've got your vet degree and you decide you want to kind of go on a little further. Can you explain, what you want to do with your master's and what you're working on as well?
So my master's is infectious disease. And for me, with the fish, 90% of the problems that I see are infectious disease related. So I really wanted to have a better understanding of different infectious processes, not necessarily that those are the exact processes that I'm dealing with, but that's a really nice way of, you know, being able to relate to other problems and, you know, figuring out how, you know, a certain disease process works in another animal. It may not be the same in fish, but it could have similar ideologies. So that's why I started to pursue that master's, and I would love to eventually go on for my PhD.
Great. All right. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit, and now we're going to kind of talk about the aquatics and disease and you being an official veterinarian. So you are both a veterinarian now and a grad student. So how are you juggling those two things? And are you kind of working with private clients as well?
What do you mean by private clients? Like fish clients or small?
Yeah, fish clients. Yeah. Or both. Either.
Right now I work full-time as a small animal vet and part-time, and I'm hoping to be more full-time with the fish. Currently, the hospital that I'm working at currently is supporting these fish dreams, and hopefully within the next coming months, having a fish-only facility. And in terms of juggling everything, it's a seven-day-a-week process right now, and I squeeze, you know, studying in, you know, after work or in the middle of the night, and I see my fish clients. I do a lot via like telehealth. And occasionally I'll go out to those clients for, you know, diagnostic purposes, but a lot fortunately has been via, you know, email, text. Fortunately, I'll have clients, you know, they'll have like a microscope. I'll have them scale scrape. I'll show them how to do all that procedure, and then I'll have them just send me the images to review.
Okay, that's great. Are you working in Long Island then?
Yes.
Okay, cool. You can say, what's the name of your clinic?
Massapequa Pet Vet.
Massapequa. Okay, sounds good. So if anyone has any fish issues, they can kind of find you there.
Yeah, absolutely. And then so then the offshoot is aquatic veterinary medicine and diagnostic services.
Okay, sounds good. Now, you co-authored a chapter on coral and aquatic invert diseases, which is you know, obviously really cool at this stage for you. Can you tell us how you got involved with that?
So I have a passion for imaging or microscopy, and I really like to image parasites because I've always gotten frustrated looking at texts and seeing, you know, like literature and seeing like black and white grainy images and not being able to really look and identify what I'm looking at. So over time, over the years, as I found parasites and different organisms, I've tried to take really nice high resolution images. I showed those images to Dr. Tepper, and he thought it would be interesting for me to use those images for this textbook. So then I started writing about these diseases and how I've encountered them and potential treatments, and then wrapped that up all together for this textbook chapter.
Oh, that's great. So I am going to, you know what? Let's take a short break, and we'll continue our discussion with aquatic veterinarian and researcher Dr. Alex Hall, the Reef Vet, after these messages from our sponsors.
Molly, here's your dinner. Zeus, that's not your food.
Don't let that happen to your precious cat. Elevate your cat's eating experience with the Cat Tree Tray. The Cat Tree Tray keeps your cat's food off the floor and conveniently located on the cat tree. It's the perfect way to eat. It's a beautiful wrought iron tray that easily attaches to your cat tree and keeps dogs and other critters out of your cat's dish. A must for multi-pet households. There's a 6-inch tray for large bowls and a 4-inch tray for smaller bowls. Purchase your cat tree tray today. Go right now to cattreetray.com. That's cattreetray.com. cattreetray.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
We're back and continuing our conversation with my guest, Dr. Alex Hall, the Reef Vet. So you talked a little bit about kind of your background and in terms of working now as a veterinarian. You also mentioned to me that you are consulting for the Long Island Aquarium. Can you explain a little bit about your history with the facility and how you ended up working there with them?
I've been interning there on and off since I was in my early teens. I've always been really involved and interested in the reef tank there. And the curator, Mr. Joe Ayulo, has always been a real big mentor of mine in terms of reefing and problems that I've had in the past. So we've always bounced ideas back and forth with each other. So once I graduated and once I became more involved in the medicine aspect, they were looking for someone who's involved in the reef knowledge to be able to do some medicine related things, because treating reef tanks can be really quite difficult. You know, when we use different antimicrobial drugs or different drugs in general, it may be toxic to not only the organisms you're trying to kill. And that's the big problem, is when we treat, you know, dogs and cats, the medications that we give aren't necessarily toxic to the organism, the host organism or the dog, and it's toxic to the, you know, the microbes. Whereas there's a lot of microbes in a reef tank that you necessarily don't want to kill. So it's becoming very selective and figuring out what exactly can be done when and at what concentrations.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent points. Now, I think, I know we had corresponded a while ago before, and then I've noticed that you were really active on social media, which is great. I think there's a lot to be said for kind of educating the public and you know, hobbyists, enthusiasts on, you know, the fact that there are actually veterinarians and people seeing, you know, aquatics. You got a lot of a really decent following on Instagram, for example. So what made you decide to kind of go all out on social media and to engage the public? And why do you think there's so much interest?
So it all started, I always used to send the pictures I would take to, you know, fellow reef hobbyists, fellow aquatic hobbyists. And I always got really good feedback. And they always told me, oh, you should share these pictures, you know, other people would be interested. I put it off for a long time and just kept collecting pictures and kept them, you know, between my friends and, you know, other hobbyists. And then eventually I was convinced to set up the account. And then it started to grow a lot faster than I ever expected. So then I just kept continually, you know, posting, you know, the interesting items that I've found over time. And as, you know, the more I've posted, the more I've realized that people are really interested in these topics. So I've just continued to do so. I think that a lot of people have a lot of, you know, fish are common in people's households. And I think a lot of people have a lot of problems. And the internet not necessarily has great resources. And it's a lot of, in fish medicine, the amount of anecdotal reports are massive, and a lot of people have a lot of strong feelings. So I like to create like an unbiased, you know, scientific platform rather than, you know, my feelings and thoughts, but more through a scientific lens.
That sounds good. You don't want to set up like a battle lines or anything.
No.
I'm just kidding. So speaking of then, what kind of feedback and what kind of questions do you get? You know, are there any specific questions that are pretty common, you know, that you are seeing routinely that, you know, might be of interest?
Most commonly I'm asked, you know, parasite identification, or, you know, my coral or my fish looks funny. What's wrong with it is a very common one. Or, you know, this coral is slowly decaying over time. What could those possibilities be is also very, very common. And then the next step is, how do we treat and get rid of those problems, which is gets a lot more complex, because a lot of these infectious diseases in corals, there hasn't been any, you know, real scientific literature that's described treatment in these species. It's mostly, you know, anecdotal reports that aren't really replicatable. So my goal is to go back through these anecdotal reports and hopefully find and scrutinize them and hopefully find treatments and actively prove that certain drugs work versus certain drugs don't work.
Now, are you getting any kind of weird feedback at all? Or are you getting any strange kind of comments that might be of interest?
You know, some people don't, you know, the most common weird question is like, oh, like, why are you treating a fish? Why are you driving to this person's house to treat a betta? Is a very common question. But, you know, the human animal bond is a really interesting thing. And, you know, if someone bonds to a fish the same way somebody else bonds to a dog, you know, it's not just because it's a cheaper animal or just because it's, you know, not as what other people find is loving, doesn't mean that those animals don't deserve the same treatment or respect that, you know, dogs and cats do.
Yeah, no, it's definitely true. I actually received a call years ago from a woman who had been working with her vet on her betta, spent a couple hundred bucks, called me because she didn't think her vet was doing the right thing. And I actually talked to the vet and I told her, yeah, he's doing everything right. So it's fine. But yeah, you're right. That definitely strong bonds. So I guess let's start with fish and talk. Do you have any kind of recent or favorite cases that you might want to share with us?
Yeah, so I'm really, again, interested in just disease, and I've been, become increasingly more interested in scutioscoliosis, or uraenema is the most common one. So normally I've seen mortality rates of 98, 99% within 3 days, with, species being infected with uraenema. I actually had a maroon clownfish who was infected. Normally uraenema is seen on like superficially, but ironically, she was in one of my quarantine tanks, and I was just practicing taking fecal samples. So I took her, took a sample of her feces, put it under the microscope, and then found that she had a pretty prevalent internal uraenema infection that did spread finally after hunting on the of her superficially. I was able to find it on her outside as well. And normally, mortality would be really high, but I put her on intramuscular antiprotozoals, and instead of passing away in 3 days, she did live 6 weeks. Unfortunately, she passed. I had to another event that I had to go to, and I left her with somebody else who, with very explicit instructions on how to care for her. Unfortunately, they didn't care for her the way that I, told them to, and she did pass. But I thought it was a really nice proof of concept that we went from, 3 day guaranteed mortality to 6 weeks, and she was, every day continually getting better. So hopefully the next case that I have of it was
Oh, Metro. Okay.
immediately she ulcerated. So that's like one of the more common symptoms of uraenema, is a nice red banding across the skin and then ulceration. And it was a day or two after her last injection when she was supposed to get it, but the person who was caring for her didn't give it, and she immediately almost ulcerated.
Gotcha.
So
Okay. Yeah, sorry to hear about that. So let's talk a little bit about corals now. In general, how many coral problems do you think are really more or have a large roots in husbandry? And what would be some common clinical signs for these? And also kind of what type of approach do you have for these? I know we talked a little bit about the sort of infectious nature, and obviously corals, there's so much going on that, I'm guessing is probably environmental, but what are your kind of thoughts on all that?
I'm fascinated about, I would have said 90% plus of corals that die would have died from husbandry reasons, but now I would say it's considerably less. I feel that the husbandry is relatively, for experienced people, is relatively good, and that I think infectious disease plays a larger role than I ever did think before. A lot of people, when they have, a coral that is slowly wasting away, so like commonly, if your water parameters aren't good, right, corals die relatively quickly, days to weeks. When you have corals that are slowly wasting away over time, and if it's very species specific, like if there's certain corals that are wasting away and other ones aren't, you go, okay, the water parameter and the lights and everything are most likely all right. So then why are these specific, colonies dying? And as I, look at those colonies and scrutinize them, going through each individual polyp, I'm finding more and more different types of infectious disease, like flatworms and different mites that we haven't necessarily seen before. And a lot of people get, really offended if you suggest that their tank may have Acropora eating flatworms, because those are considered, a big no-no in the hobby, and it's people get insulted by that. So people don't necessarily like to look for these things. And when they do look, they'll look standing in front of their tank. A colony will be 8 inches away from their face. The tank's really dark, or it's, with a lot of blue light, so you really can't see the coral. Besides like that really bright color, so you can't really see the tissue underneath. And they go, oh, there's no parasites here. And you're like, you have to take that colony out of the water, and I use a triocular scope and, scan every inch of that colony. I've had been at clients that had euphilia, or that are a type of LPS, and they were slowly wasting away, and they were wasting away in a very particular pattern that I've noticed. And you have, it's almost like a wave, like where it'll start on one side of the colony and slowly progress through the colony. The classic, white band disease. It's not white band disease, but it progresses in the same way. And if it was any external factors, or lighting, chemistry, you would have you know, the colony would be dying from all sides equally, instead of, you know, having these progressional fronts. So this one particular colony, I was convinced that there was, you know, some sort of ectoparasitism. Couldn't find it originally, but about 2 hours after sampling it, I started to find more and more of these flatworms. And then as we looked through the other colonies, started to find more of them. And I think a lot of people neglect looking for these flatworms, you know, so the colony will slowly die. And then once the colony dies, they'll pull it out of the tank. But by then there are no more flatworms. So then they just attribute the death to like a bacterial infection. They attribute the death to like husbandry related things, even though the initial cause of death were these types of flatworms.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I know some of these can be really pretty small. So segueing into the next question. So what would be the most common parasitic diseases that you're seeing in corals in general?
So different types of flatworms is probably the most prevalent. And for every species of coral that exists, there's some sort of species-specific flatworm that I've seen. And unfortunately, some of them can only be, you know, 1-2 millimeters in size. So without, you know, proper magnification, you wouldn't necessarily see them. A lot of them can be transparent, translucent. So they're just showing up the same color as the coral's tissue. So seeing these organisms is really difficult. And something that I've been doing that I've found helps me identify these is I'll take a sample of the coral, put it under a triocular scope. I use my phone camera and hook that up to the scope. And then I time lapse. So I can see small movements over, you know, a large, so, you know, I'll let it run for an hour and then I'll be able to see organisms moving. Because if you just look at it and look by your naked eye, you necessarily wouldn't see these organisms even moving because they move so slowly. But by time lapsing them, I'm able to see, you know, the organisms traveling around the coral. So that makes it a lot easier to identify.
Cool. Yeah. Very, very cool. I don't think a lot of people probably have thought of that. Now, you mentioned general challenges with coral medicine, and yeah, definitely quite a few. So where do you think kind of clinical research needs to go, and what do you, you mentioned a little bit about that. What would you be interested in trying to do on that front?
I think it needs to go more into like a practicality realm rather than theoretical. And I think a lot of coral research that has been done has all been ocean-related. And the diseases in the ocean are very different than diseases in home tank aquaria. In the ocean, you have basically, it's an unlimited supply of water. Everything is scaled massively. So you don't get these really high concentrations of parasites the same way that we do in a tank. You know, you have a 40-gallon tank. The speed at which these diseases perpetuate in these enclosed systems is far greater than when it is in the ocean. So I think in like actual tank treatments are a different avenue than looking at these diseases in the ocean. You know, Acropora eating flatworms in the ocean aren't necessarily as big of a deal as they are within a, you know, a home tank full of only Acropora. The speed at which these parasites can replicate is a lot higher. So I think that treatment needs to be designed for at home, rather than just looking at these diseases and parasites in the wild.
So with regard to these flatworms, what's kind of your standard recommendation for quarantine and management or treatment if they're there?
So I guess the bane of all reefers exists, the Acropora eating flatworms. I've seen 4 different subtypes personally. I'm sure there's a lot out there. It's unfortunately, there's no advisable in-tank treatment at this time. And that's something that I've personally started to look into and experimenting with at home. But these organisms is, you know, you buy a frag or you buy a small piece from, you know, a retailer, wholesaler, friend, wherever that may be. And it's really important to, you know, look under a magnifying glass and really examine that coral for any possibility of eggs or any of the larger, you know, adult flatworms. Again, some of them can be only a few millimeters in size. So once you, you know, set up a small quarantine system away from your tank, ideally off the water supply, you know, that has its own system, but a lot of people can't do that. So, you know, inline quarantine systems may be more of a possibility for some people. Granted, that's not a full quarantine, but it at least allows you to examine that coral daily, maybe even, you know, twice daily. I really like to look at night, because that's when a lot of these parasites come out. Once when the lights go dim, you know, they'll start to crawl around the coral. So you can really examine it. I really don't think that, you know, you should buy coral and then immediately place it into your tank, because that's how disasters happen. A lot of the times with these flatworms, you can use like a toothbrush or something to manually remove the eggs. There are some over-the-counter dips that they don't necessarily eradicate the worms, but they will irritate them. And if you give the coral a bath and shake it around in these dips, it'll knock some of them off, or it'll at least allow you to identify that they're there. And I think knowing that they're there is half the problem. Because a lot of times, if you have corals or colonies dying, if you know what the problem is, you're not running down another avenue experimenting, thinking that it's a chemical problem. And then you start experimenting with the chemistry, and then you could end up, killing more coral and more of an issue. So I think really properly examining new coral is the most important thing.
Okay, sounds good. So where do you see yourself in the next 5 and 10 years?
That's a good question. In the next 5, I'd really love to have my aquatics hospital up and running with surgery and in-house, bacterial culture diagnostics. 10 years, I feel like that's really far out to know exactly what I'd be doing. I'm definitely going to be within this hobby or within this field of medicine. I don't know exactly where that'll take me. Will I be more interested in the coral disease? Will I be more interested in the fish disease? Originally, I was more interested in coral disease. But then as I've gotten more involved in the medicine, now I do more of the fish disease as well. So I think it's going to be a balance between the two.
Or coral reef organism health as a career?
I mean, I'm a really big fan of the veterinary school route. Some other people who go the marine bio route, and they don't necessarily, they understand antibiotics, but they don't necessarily understand when, why, and how we use them. So I think having a medical knowledge is really good at dealing with these problems. I don't think that the medical knowledge allows you to identify what the problems are. I think that's comes from experience over time. So I think it's the experience over time that allows you to identify the problem, but it's the medical knowledge that allows you to come up with solutions and able to, accurately attack these problems and hopefully find a cure.
And before we close up and I ask you the final question, you have to give us a minute or two on judo. So tell me about your kind of experience with judo. I see you were nationally, internationally ranked and all that. So yeah, tell me a little bit about your judo experiences.
Yeah, so I started when I was 6 or 7. Originally, I had an Olympic dream. My dream was actually to compete in 2024. But unfortunately, when I was 19, I had a pretty substantial injury that was career ending. So then at that time, I broke my back, had compression fractures up through my thoracic spine. And that's when I really shifted from sports to more of an academic mindset. So before then, I put all my time and effort into training. And that was, a 7-day-a-week thing. Once that injury happened, I found something else to fill that time. So I really went from, really sports heavy to really academic heavy, and started training for veterinary medicine and training my brain rather than my body.
Yeah, that's always a challenge, but things happen for a reason, right? So
Oh, and I'm happier with where I'm at now versus then, so all things work out.
But could you still hurt somebody though if you really wanted to? You wouldn't want to, I know, of course. No, I appreciate that. And definitely enjoyed speaking with you, Alex. Hopefully you'll come down and visit at some point if you ever have some time.
Absolutely.
Come down. And yeah, I'd love to talk with you a little more, show you around. So unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to, again, thank our guest, Dr. Alex Hall, and our producer, Mark Winter, for making this show possible. And Alex, so the last question is, do you have any just final words of wisdom in general for our listeners, any topic?
Yeah. So with coral or even fish, always really, really examine what you're looking at when you're buying. And even if the fish you're buying looks clean, if you're in a store, look around in the other tanks that are nearby. Look in the other tanks that are, plumbed into the same system. Do they have diseases in those tanks? Because if they're in those tanks, it's highly possible that the fish that you're buying is exposed. So don't only look at the fish or coral that you're buying. Try to take a look at everything around it.
Great advice. Well, please be sure to check out Alex's social media links, which will be found on his Aquariumania episode page. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for a show, email me at drroy@petliferadio.com. That's drroy@petliferadio.com. Until next time, please visit your local aquarium stores, keep your tanks clean, and your coral reef systems healthy.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on petliferadio.com.